My name is Corliss Burke. I'm a very grateful friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have the honor of serving on the General Service Board as a non-alcoholic trustee. So I'd like to start our session this morning with a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 75 years. The first of the three speakers that we have for our session this morning on AA and treatment facilities is Dr. Al Mooney. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Mooney, who practices addiction and family medicine in North Carolina. In his current clinical and personal activities, Al systematically strives to help anyone with a desire to stop drinking to become familiar with AA. In speaking of his work, Dr. Mooney has said, "I'm tired of seeing people with a desire to stop drinking die in the mental health system without knowing about AA." Dr. Mooney joined Alateen when he was 13 years old and has attended open AA meetings throughout his adult life. He's a member of Al-Anon and has served on the steering committee of the International Doctors in AA. Dr. Mooney's parents founded Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia, and Dr. Mooney serves as president of this foundation, which provides addictions treatment and training for students in an abstinent 12-step environment. Dr. Mooney served on the board of the American Society of Addiction Medicine during the 1980s and was among the first physicians to be certified in addictions medicine. He's a co-author of the Recovery Book. Along with an AA member, Dr. Al, as he's affectionately known, brought medical detox, big books, meetings, and hope to alcoholic victims of Hurricane Katrina. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Al Mooney?
Good morning, everybody. I've got a timer. If you know me, you know I need a timer. I brought a couple of notes, not to remember what I'm going to say, but to try to keep it on task so I can do it within the time I set on my timer. And I brought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm an AA wannabe. And sometimes it's awkward being in an AA group. And it is interesting because this is an AA meeting, and I am very, very honored, humbled, and scared to death being here right now, but it's a pleasure, and it just touches my heart to see that so many people turn out to share their experience in strength and hope, and that's what I hope to do as I'm talking in these very, very few minutes for those of you that know me. But I'm really humbled by being here. I want to thank some people first, because just an opportunity to come up here and be a part of this event is really a high point in my life. So I want to thank the committee, the Treatment Centers Committee at GSO, for inviting me and letting me be a part of this. I can't think of anything in my life that I would rather be doing. I want to thank GSO for the hospitality. There was a nice gift basket in my room. I'm here with my wife Jane, and the traditions really work at GSO. I've tried to, you know, to pay for things and do for things. They said, no, we are self-supporting. We want to remind you. And so, you know, it has been really, I'm not used to taking things from alcoholics. It works the other way in my life. So I'm truly humbled by that simple gesture from GSO and the traditions. I also want to thank the North Carolina leadership in AA, because had it not been for people recognizing some of the things that the AA members that I've been working with have been doing, and the contributions it's made to helping carry a message of recovery to the suffering alcoholic, I wouldn't be here no matter what else I thought about what I was doing. And I also want to thank individual AA members for being a part of something that I think is great. We're already a part of something that was great in the 20th century, because I firmly believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest human services movement of the 20th century. We're not far enough along in the 21st century to know, but I hope, and I will do everything in my power to continue that for another century. There's some bumps in the road, and I hope everybody recognizes that. But I know I'll be there. Those people that know me know that I'll be there, too. And I also want to thank Corliss for that kind introduction. It doesn't sound like me, but I'm getting up here when she told me to. So. And as we talked yesterday, Corliss asked me to basically share my experience, strength, and hope in sharing with you about my ideas about how members of Alcoholics Anonymous can assist professionals in learning about AA and getting into AA, which is really, I've tried other things in my life, in my medical career and in other careers I've had, but my higher power has continually, and I'm very glad that it has happened, but it certainly was not my path. My higher power has steered me back to working with alcoholics and addicts. And a lot of those people in the public mental health system, I work with a homeless shelter and, in Raleigh, and I've talked with people who were at that homeless shelter in Moore Square before the Healing Place, and now they're here at the International AA Convention helping other alcoholics and carrying a message of recovery. When everybody in my state had given up on these people and let them walk the streets of Raleigh, North Carolina. So this program works. I wish I had more time to talk about the Healing Place. Wish I had more time to talk about my experience with treatment, because I have been privileged to watch, truly watch the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous at work. And part of my job, and it's kind of a thankless one, is going back into the, and the big book talks about those sordid places, and I've got a couple of those I'll tell you about, but the medical mental health community is a sordid place that I spend a lot of my time trying to open doors for Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I get discouraged, these AA members remind me that there's some people that literally were pronounced dead that now are in recovery, and we've been doing this 2 or 3 years, and we've got people with 2 or 3 years of recovery now that are a result of some of this. So I want to briefly talk about that. But why am I such a, so passionate about AA? And sometimes as a physician, I have to remind myself, I like to think of myself as a scientist, but a physician primarily needs to be a healer. And in the medical scientific world today, we often fall back to science that is either late in coming to help people or is misrepresenting what science is about. And there's some things happening right now that are very interesting that show how, on happy birthday AA, 75 years, how AA for 75 years has been doing things that, thank God, we didn't wait on science to catch up to start doing these things, because I don't think we have the gray pages in the grapevine anymore, but the gray pages used to talk about science. And unfortunately, I talked with a lot of people in the program who really don't, don't pay much attention to science. And I remind people that in chapter 5, in the doctor's opinion, which used to start with page 1 in the big book, now there's a lot of Roman numerals, and Bill's story is page 1. But Dr. Silkworth's theory of an allergy kicked this whole thing off. And he was not an alcoholic. He loved alcoholics. But that was the scientific principle. And that was about all that was known in 1935 about addiction, is that people, normal people who had a craving, satisfied the craving, and they didn't have the craving anymore. But there's an abnormal physical reaction that an alcoholic has to a substance called alcohol, that when you get what you crave, you need more. That is an abnormal reaction to a physical substance. That's the physical allergy. And that's about all we knew. The recent science, and I won't have time to talk about this, but this is one of the things that I tried my best to be a Dr. Silkworth in 2010, because I deal with some people who are intelligent enough to know if you say you've got a terminal disease like cancer and heart disease, and here's a doctor from 1935 you need to listen to, I have people say, whoa, you mean I should go to a 1935 doctor about my cancer or my heart disease? And, it doesn't pass some people's smell test, and their reason, and Big Book, when the Big Book history has difficulty, reconciling, with what people feel today, there needs to be, people need to explain it. A lot of people other than me explaining how the Big Book and history of Alcoholics Anonymous reconcile with 2010. And one of the things that it reconciles with is what I saw that got me interested in this in 1959. When my dad started AA, it was in prison, and it was Addicts Anonymous. It was not Alcoholics Anonymous. But he came back and joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had a psychic change. I know the Big Book describes psychic change. I went to medical school later and was told that your brains don't change. Once you have a stroke, once you have a personality, once you have a mental disease, you're going to be that way, and you just have to kind of add as much strength to your life as you can. Wrong. Everything we were taught for 50 years in healthcare is wrong. There literally is, and I won't get into the science, but there's something we call neuroplasticity. that has been a magnificent discovery of science in the last 10 years that has not even been applied in the addiction area. Scientists accept that your brain molds to become more addicted. But the science of recovery, where my life lives, the neuroplasticity, the brain changes, are really just very, very much a threshold in science. So those of you that are young enough to live another 20 or 30 years, and that's a lot of people I've seen around the streets in Alcoholics Anonymous here, are going to have your toes curled with the science of how AA and the fellowship and the spiritual program works. There are some other areas of science that make AA more relevant than ever, not the least of which is America spends twice as much money as anybody else in the world on health care. There's no country, the Netherlands is number two, and they spend half as much as we do. And yet, if you put a list, and this report came out 2 weeks ago, if you take a list of developed countries, America is by far the bottom of the list as far as life expectancy. And there's a little mud on the face of people in Washington who are spending all this money on technology, and yet we have the lifespan of a third world country. The one shining star in America's healthcare system, guess where it comes? It comes from Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is what is beginning to be called in scientific circles the science of behavior change. It's very early, but it's happening and it's developing in a way that AA, in my opinion, needs to be there to be the poster child of how we accomplish that. And there are ways to engage in that professional community that is starved for that kind of science. So thank God for those AA members who are willing to come into those sordid mental health places and carry a message of hope and recovery. Let me talk about where we have gotten. I don't have time to go back into a lot of what it was like for me, but I did grow up in an alcoholic family. I watched the psychic change with my dad. I had a chance to meet Bill Wilson. I had wonderful opportunities in my life that very few professionals in the role that I am are privileged to have. And then in my career, I found myself working in a 5-county mental health district. I'm really responsible for about 230,000 lives of people in mental health. I come from a medical background, and when I looked at death reports, which is part of my job, I was pretty astounded and horrified to see that many of the death reports that I read were people who, in their charts, had said they had a desire to stop drinking. And in their lives, they had a life that had been disrupted with alcohol, prescription drugs, and illegal drugs. Prescription drugs now probably is our country's number one drug problem. And they were never introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I set out, because of my horror at seeing that, to change that. And I called a number of people, and they said, "Dr. Mooney, you're from mental health. You know, we can't talk with you." I had lots of reactions. But I found a few people who have been willing to help bridge that gap between mental health, medicine, primary care, and the AA community. Matter of fact, I know there's some people here, and there may be questions after the meeting. If you've worked with me in any of these programs, raise your hand. Great. So your hands go up. Quiz those people about what we have done, because we won't do anything except scratch the surface here. But it started in a program where I did an internship in surgery. And the surgery program, I was going to be a surgeon. This is one of these diversions in my life. One day the surgeons were very frustrated because we had people come in 1 week with a gunshot. We'd save their lives, fix them up, send them home. Next week it'd be a stab wound. And next week, after we fixed them up, they'd come back with bleeding ulcers. And the residents were real upset one day and asked Dr. Polk at University of Louisville, what does this mean? We're not sure we're helping these people. And Dr. Polk, only an academic surgeon's way to do this, said, "Guys, you need to know one thing if you're going to be a surgeon in America, and that is that everybody on this earth has a purpose in life, and some people's purpose in life is to teach surgeons how to operate." And I had come out of a recovering community. It wasn't until I got to medical school and my internship that I actually saw alcoholics die. Everybody I saw got sober and lived happily ever after. And I think now we may see less recovery, lower recovery rates than we did in those days. You know, again, we don't have time to talk about that, but I've got a lot of opinion about that too. But the surgeons went right back to work. Nobody batted an eye, and they're still out there practicing today. This was 1975. But I knew that something was wrong with that picture. And about 20 years later, I was asked to come back and do an attending rounds, or those same grand rounds, in the surgical unit at the new University of Louisville Hospital, and tag along behind all these academic guys. And every bed we got to, when they got talking about the surgical cases, they say, "Dr. Mooney, you have something to say?" And in half of those 8 beds, I had a chance to teach about substance abuse, alcoholism, drug addiction, and that sort of thing. So things changed immediately. It was a service that was called an angel call service that was more effective than social workers or psychiatry. It was basically just having homeless people who had just learned about AA from the Healing Place in Louisville come in and do calls, 12-step calls. When I got to, I have to kind of close it down now. My buzzer went off. So when I got back into the community health world, I said, why do these people have to die in my environment? Why can't we do the angel call thing? And then we set out to do that. And the results have really been phenomenal. People, and these are often sick people who are in what we call target populations. A number of our people have been, I don't know whether they were pronounced dead, but several. It's not unusual for us to hear a story where somebody was given CPR and they came back to life, called our peer, who in your world is a 12-step call. In our world, we call them peers. Again, this little translation necessary. But we've done training, because in the old days, if you wanted to go to a hospital, you just went to a hospital. But with HIPAA, with terrorism, with security, we've had to engineer, I call it a credential, just like when Tom and I did, and we're trying to replicate that. In the prison, you have to have an ID. You have to go through a couple of hoops to get into the prisons. Well, we've created a similar kind of credential in the professional world. I wish I had more time to talk about that, but I wanted to introduce you to the concept of how the AA community, willing to come into my world as peers, can do like the Big Book says in Chapter 7, Working with Others, where it says, you know, you can go to the most sordid places on earth, and if your motives are right, God will protect you. And so all you have to do is agree that mental health is a sordid place, and then you get directions from the Big Book. And I've had a couple of tough AA members that didn't want to come to mental health, and those of you that know me know I'm a big fan of the Big Book, because it solves a lot of the barriers that I have doing work with alcoholics who still suffer. I want to let you know how grateful I am to be here. I think there was one other thing I wanted. Oh, one other thing. I said I was an alcoholic wannabe. And I've got several people that each week ask me, have you started drinking yet, Al? Because we really need you in this program. And I refuse to do that. And now I can go back and tell Ken, who's the guy that asked me that every week. I'll say, Ken, I actually talked at an AA meeting. I said, I feel more than I ever have in my life a part of AA. And the miracle in my life is you guys, I'm a wimp. You guys paid the dues to be here. And somehow I have the privilege of being here without paying the dues that you have. So I am grateful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a grateful friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.
To tell you, Dr. Al, that we are very grateful for your participation this morning and for your support of AA. Your enthusiasm is infectious, and we appreciate that so much. Our next speaker is Michelle Hyland. Michelle is the Director of Youth Development Services at Day One, which is a substance abuse prevention and treatment program in southern Maine. It serves the entire state of Maine. Michelle oversees prevention, intervention, and juvenile justice programs that provide substance abuse services to youth and their families. Michelle has worked as a clinician, a supervisor, manager, and director in substance abuse and mental health since 1988, most recently focusing on young people and the challenges that they face with addiction. Michelle has a master's degree in social work and is a non-alcoholic recovery ally. Please welcome Michelle Hyland.
Thank you all, and to save some time, I'm going to say ditto to what Al said about the gratitude. It's amazing and it's wonderful to be here. Just walking through the rooms is just a delight. I'm going to come from a very different angle, and I'm going to be very specific to Maine, where we need your help. So even if you're not going to be up there, send all your spiritual energy. My focus today is going to be on some of the help that we need with AA's orientation to Maine's young outpatient substance abuse treatment providers and case managers, our referral comprehensible to the unique Maine teenager, ages 15 through 17. Every teenager in the world is unique. But in Maine, we are extra special. And I am the Flatlander as teacher, so if you're not familiar with that term from up north, I think it's used in the south as well. In the west, I will explain. I'm going to go a little bit over my professional again. I'm currently the director of services at Day One. And most of our services are for ages 24 and under. And nearly 47% of the programs I oversee are to incarcerated youth. The average age of our new hires throughout our agency, which is the only agency in the state of Maine that serves youth specifically, is 24. Newly out of graduate school, eager to engage with youth, and most importantly, willing to do work for a small salary and good vacation. That's how we get them in the door. Then they like us and they stay. I'm a social worker who received my graduate degree in New York City in 1988 at the age of 28, an age that is relevant to my primary points. Pay attention to the ages. At that time, I was not surprised that there was a course offered in alcohol abuse and that it was from a top-notch professor. And there was no way that attending AA meetings was not going to be required as part of that personal experience. Attend 3 open AA meetings, observe and write your personal experience attending to each. I remember it perfectly well out of Professor Brody's mouth, and the fact that I even remember his name tells you a lot about the impact that that course and that experience had on my life. I'm going to fast forward a couple of years, and I'm a practicing therapist out in Indiana at a community mental health center, where Connection with Emotions Anonymous was built into our psychiatric partial hospital program and many of our outpatients. So I was very fortunate that 12-step principles, traditions, and slogans remained integral to my life personally and professionally. Very, very, very lucky. I need to admit I never wanted to work in substance abuse treatment. While passionate about recovery, I did not think that it was my calling. At the time I came into this field, one needed to be a person in recovery. That was the primary credential. I didn't match or meet that credential. But when I was fortunate enough to acquire a job in substance abuse in Maine, I was astounded at how right a fit it was and how very fortunate I was to go into an agency where AA was integrated well into the whole spectrum of treatment. But some very important things happened during my 6 years with that agency. Our payment sources shifted to require inclusion of more staff who received graduate level training. This meant hiring staff, many of whom did not enter the field out of their own recovery, many of whom had no experience in 12-step principles or traditions, while bringing other wonderful talents to the program, but often enough struggled themselves with the concept of powerlessness. We all know how easy it is to get that concept. So at 24, you really, 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 you want to buy into that. So over the past 20 years of advanced professionalism within substance abuse treatment, the research, including the quantity and increasing quality of the AA-related scientific studies, continues to help us professionally to offer better and more informed services to youth, families in recovery. It permits us to approach treatment in a multitude of ways. And then, of course, comes the World Wide Web. Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, and you now can have AA online, which is wonderful. Very important key concept for our youth in Maine. We have a highly rural state. And so I'm appalled at how many of our practitioners in Maine are not even familiar with the open meetings online. So I now integrate it into my ethics course as one of their responsibilities to know the World Wide Web. A little bit about my personal story, just quickly. I was born 35, or so I was told at the age of 30 by a trusted friend, also known as my former husband, who knew me well. And he was right. So understanding powerlessness, unmanageability, hope, and service were not significantly challenging for me at 35. I'm not saying that I didn't have to find my way with it, but it was a challenge. And yet at the same time, I have to admit, I felt I had a little bit of an old soul that had a little bit more understanding of that. And I mistook that assumption that many of my employees coming out of graduate school shared that experience. They did not. Calamity, disaster, I grew up with them. They were amidst the many experiences offered within a family led by an alcoholic father. Simultaneously, I was really fortunate because I experienced an amazing gift in the form of the Salvation Army, the Cambridge Corps, which was one block away where I had very strong spiritual leadership. No alcohol was allowed. Doesn't mean it didn't happen in the church community, but not with my friends. I was really, really fortunate that it wasn't part of my life. So most of us had a safe haven of supportive guidance and kindness. So as I said before, I'm a passionate recovery ally, and it is my goal in life to get it, to keep it one day at a time, continuing to understand what your journey is like and what my journey is like along that path. And my responsibility and the purpose of my talk today is how to ensure that new young people coming into the field who themselves are not in recovery really begin to get that and understand how to guide teenagers, in particular at 15, 16, and 17, to know what the community resources are. We know that treatment only goes so far. We know that only treatment sometimes is a stepping off point for some people, if that at all. But we know the spirit of what AA brings them. When I asked my father's permission to share a bit of his story simply by saying he's a recovering alcoholic, he said, "Oh, sure, just make sure that one thing is clear. I drank purely because I liked to drink. It was purely for selfish reasons." And in my mind, I thought, "Oh, yeah, Dad, that's like telling the room something they haven't figured out." I did hold my tongue. I held my tongue. He does let me mouth off to him because he is so stuck. He lives with me. Dad's been sober since 1983. I am grateful each day for him, for his sobriety, recovery, and living, breathing amends. My favorite part is that he does my breakfast dishes each morning, and if anyone ever tells you it's not part of amends and you tell him that, it will not be a happy day. I want him to think it's part of amends. Works for me. When I accepted this opportunity to talk, I drew upon my experience with the Juvenile Treatment Network, which is statewide, and made arrangements to meet independently with a number of recovering young people. I was absolutely spoiled to be in their presence. And also a group that we called a brain jam on what their ideas. And what I focused on was I wanted to learn from them who and how, from whom and how were they introduced to and educated about AA. For the purpose of this, I was not interested in what their experience was once in AA. I really wanted to look at what are we doing, those of us not in recovery, what are we doing to help you get there? Sadly, while not a scientific study, I learned that over 70% of them, again, who had young counselors, had never, ever even been informed of AA. And then I remembered my own experience in the field of how many people just really wondered about whether the sense of powerlessness was appropriate to introduce to people that young. I see heads shaking. You know it is. There's just a different way to do it. And that's our job, is to learn how to translate that. I'm interested in addressing how we can do a better 12-step orientation for staff, actually officially build it into our training program when they come in the door. We have all the licensure checkoff, all of that kind of stuff. How are we introducing them to that? Particularly for outpatient substance abuse treatment in Maine for youths ages 15 through 17 who self-report that they, the staff, are not in recovery. Recent research about adolescent brain development redefines adolescence at ages 13 to 24 or 25. Assuming this age extension beyond 18 to be accurate, it means that some of our employees we hire themselves are experiencing developing adolescent brains, where their deliberative thinking of weighing costs and benefits, thinking ahead, regulating impulses, and reasoning, judgment, motivation is still developing. Remember, I was born 35, so I didn't have to go through any of that. I do want to be clear, though, again, there are a lot of very mature people where that may not apply. But at the same time, I am seeing that some of our younger people with less experience really themselves struggle with understanding, if I don't understand powerlessness, if I don't understand a higher power, how do I pass that on and have a sense of belief that this next generation that I'm counseling can do that? I'll give you one example, though. I had an employee himself in his 40s. I'm giving an example of the adolescent brain. The employee who was in his 40s didn't have the adolescent brain. But I'll tell you. He might have. He was a guy, yeah. John said it. I did not say it. He did. And he had used for a number of years of his life. I think he was still catching up. I actually turned red from that one. He used to say to our juvenile drug treatment court group, They say they cannot get to a meeting, but they can organize a drug deal, which involves contacting their supplier, pick up, and sometimes selling. They can get to a meeting. I wondered about that, too, and I still want to throw out another story that helps us understand both sides of it and how we, as at least as providers, can help translate that a little bit better. And just quickly, I went to a conference and I learned, and one of the things that they were talking about was, it was in 2002, a number of high school seniors, as their final prank, were going to streak through the lunchroom on the last day of classes. They mapped it out for weeks. They figured every single detail out, including how they would cover their faces and their hair so that they couldn't be noticed, and supposedly the rest of their bodies had not already been known, so that they had their getaway, they had everything going. There was one thing that they hadn't anticipated. There was a 23-year-old substitute teacher that day in the lunchroom. 23, possibly still adolescent brain. So the streakers are coming through the room. I mean, picture it in this room. It's about this size. They're going through. They figured out. They knew the timing of everything. The 23-year-old panicked and closed the door. All the other teachers were just stepping back, going, oh, let's just let it happen. It's the last day of school, whatever. The panic happened so bad that really, when they finally figured out how to get out, there was a police chase, there were arrests, it was a mess, it was awful. But my point being that sometimes when you get into that stage, you can't always anticipate those same consequences. You can't think through all of those kinds of things. And again, when I have 24, 25-year-old new providers trying to learn things, I need to help them think through the consequences of extra steps to translate. How do you help someone understanding what that journey is like to get to an AA meeting? Particularly when, what I want to emphasize is, our young adult and our youth movement of meetings in Maine are very, very, very limited. They're very limited already in the southern part of the state. Up in the north, they're pretty non-existent. So you really want to help design a program where people can go and be mentored. It is so important. And sometimes the word sponsorship is so, so scary. Mentoring, not so scary. Not saying replace it, but think about it. There are sometimes ways for some youth where temporarily you ask them to consider a different word to help get them there. The other thing I just want to also point out that's the biggest challenge is now where our youth age 15 to 17 more often than not are polydrug users. And I know AA itself is struggling with what do we do when there's not a single place to do that. So in closing, I have a few other comments here. I just want to go through this piece. A couple of things to think about. I remember when referring adults to AA for the first time, our practice was to say, listen for what you have in common. We did this in an effort to help the individual listen for how to connect, how to fit in. Well, adolescents want to fit in, but they do not want to fit in with AA. I know you're shocked. What adolescent in hers or her right mind, never mind substance abusing mind, wants to fit in with AA during the first few visits? Hi, I'm Michelle. I'm 16. You're telling me for the rest of my life I can't drink alcohol and that I'm going to find a very rewarding life. Thank you very much. Where are the car keys? So one concept we have is setting that up in such a way where they are borrowing powerlessness. We're not asking them to purchase it. Where they are borrowing and trying on a higher power. Just a different way. So when they ask to borrow the car keys, you say, yes, thank you very much. When you borrow powerlessness and promise not to drink and drive, you sort of do it in a very different way as some of the translation that we're trying to think of and experimenting as non-alcoholic providers trying to translate to our very, very, very special and significant Maine youth. We know how dangerous it is to have to be unique, and yet at the same time, we know how important that is to an adolescent, to their development, to their sense of momentum, and to their movement. So that's part of the effort, is we're trying to balance those two worlds, get them in earlier in an area that doesn't have unique AA programs to young people. So send your spiritual energy up north. That's what we want to do. We'd appreciate that. And I'm just going to close with one story. It's actually a quote from a novel. In a 2003 novel entitled Outstealing Horses by Per Peterson, his primary character, who's an adult in his 60s, is reflecting upon the purchase of a house and property that require a fair amount of work. He says, quote, although everyone says I could have asked anybody around here and they would have told me what a state the house was in, that many people had wanted the place on account of its lovely situation, but none of them felt like taking it on because of the work that was needed to make it fit to live in, then I say it was just as well I didn't know, for then I would not have bought the house. I would not have found out it quite possible to live in if you don't demand too much of it, but just take one step at a time. That suits me fine, I say. I have plenty of time. I'm not going anywhere. End of quote. For me, that's an introduction to recovery. When it comes to adolescents, they are going somewhere all the time. So we have to think very differently about how to entice them to that journey so that they can find a more satisfying help with higher power. And I thank you very much for this time.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I think the staff and the adolescents that you work with are very fortunate, and I really appreciate you sharing your wisdom and your experience and strength with us today. I can see that that translates into your work, and thank you. I don't know if you all heard that. She said, I appreciate your comments, especially because the adolescents really don't appreciate me. I think they do, and I think they will later on in their lives, for sure. Our third speaker this morning is Dr. John Sader. It's such a privilege for me and a pleasure to introduce a fellow Canadian. Dr. Sader is a family physician. He's specialized in the treatment of dependencies and is a member of the American Board of Addictions Medicine. Dr. Sader is also a diplomat of the American Society of Addictions Medicine. He is not a recovering alcoholic, but came to know AA in 1983 during his studies at McGill University in Montreal. During this time, in order to understand the AA program, he attended open AA meetings twice a week. Dr. Sader states that this experience changed his life, and he went on to work as director of a specialized addictions treatment center in Montreal for 12 years. Presently, Dr. Sader is working at the Family Medicine Group Clinic, which prioritizes patients with psychiatric or behavioral vulnerabilities, including dependence on alcohol. Please join me in welcoming Dr. John Sader.
Oops, I need my props. Here, we'll just leave them here for now. Nothing in there, right? Okay. Well, first I got to thank Al and Michelle because, hey, they respected their time limit. So, hey, we got an hour and 10 minutes. You guys are in trouble. And because we have a little bit of time, I'm going to explain a little bit more why AA vibrates with me. Okay, and the first thing I want to do, I want to thank Michelle, who is a 29-year-old alcoholic, cocaine addict, that I met at the welcoming committee at the door when you go into your first AA meeting when I was 23. Now, my life story, I can't go into all of it, but I was very hurt when I was very young by situations that I really loved. And that had a repercussion on me. I thought I was smart when I was 7 years old. And, you know, when you do this kind of equation in your head, and I'm sure none of you have ever done this, but I did it. If you love a lot, when you get hurt, you hurt a lot. And when you're really young, you feel like you're dying. And I wanted to survive, you know. I didn't want to die. And so I made this equation. It was very mathematical. Well, if I don't love so much, well, then I can't get hurt so much and nothing will kill me. Well, I thought that was really smart. Nobody's ever done that, eh? No, nobody here, I'm sure. So I carried that armor around with me for the longest time. And when I was 15, I had a very depressive episode because I moved from a rural community into an urban community where everything was upper middle class and posh, and I was living in a trailer for 3 years because my dad is a hydroelectrical engineer working on James Bay and places like that. So, hey, this was difficult. Well, I was going to school with kids when I was 13 who had known each other, were best friends since they were two. Try to get into a group like that when you got hair out to here, braces, Coke bottle glasses. You're the ugliest nerd in the place. It was tough. And when I was 15, I had some sort of existential depression. It was very difficult. And I got out of it, and I got out of it in the strangest of ways. I turned my aggressivity, instead of turning it towards myself, I turned it outside, but I internalized it a little bit like you go out and cut a cord of wood when you're pissed off at your neighbor. Well, at least something good comes out of it, right? So I decided I'm going to show them that I'm somebody. And so I studied. And so I became a doctor because I hated people. Actually, it didn't work entirely like that. But I studied hard because I hated people. And for some reason, the depression went away almost. In psychiatrists call it dysthymia. Kind of, how you doing, John? I'm surviving. I'm sure nobody here knows that feeling either. And so I carried that along till I was about 23, and I'm doing a research project at McGill with families of alcoholics, and during our studies with them, we discovered that rats, some of them are alcoholics too. And Dr. Maurice Dongier at the Douglas Hospital said, John, ethically, we can't just leave this like this. The books all say that Alcoholics Anonymous helps these people, but some people complain. They say, is it a sect? Is it a religion? Is it a cult? What is it? He says, I want you to make up your own mind on what AA is. And I want you to do at least 5 meetings. So it took me as a non-alcoholic at least 3 weeks, maybe 4, to find the courage to go to a meeting. And I walk in the door. I walk in the door and I'm greeted by Michel, 29-year-old alcoholic, cocaine addict, recovery. And, you know, he says, hi, my name's Michel, and I'm an alcoholic. And I say, hi, my name's John, and I'm a human being. And Michel looked at me and said, what are you talking about? Well, then I explained my whole McGill, Dr. Dongier, I had explained the whole research thing. And he said, well, I've got, you know, this is what, while I'm explaining this, Michel's buddies, gather around, and they're all looking at me. And then I saw this moment, this epiphany, this something happened in the glint of their eye, they all looked at each other. And what they said, what I heard, but which they didn't say out loud, was, we never heard that lie before. So, they proceeded to do everything in their power to get me to crack. They ganged up on me, 5-on-1. They did 1-on-1. They did the 1-on-1 till 3:30 in the morning, talk into the night. They did the, buy him a beer, he'll lose control, and he'll end up bawling until it's... And they were wrong, but they were right. Because what I perceived was, hey, these are good people. I haven't seen people like this in a while. It wasn't because they weren't there. It was because my glasses weren't adjusted. Couldn't see them. But these guys, I could see them, and more, I could feel them. And every time I went to a meeting and I heard somebody share, I got butterflies in my stomach and my hair stood up on end. And I'm going, I like this place. And I ended up doing meetings for 2 years, twice a week. They went as far as to trick me to go into a closed meeting. That's how far they went. That experience changed my life, saved my life, cured my dysthymia because I succeeded in taking off my armor, and just made me decide to go into medical school to do addictions. That was the point. So I think everybody owes a candle to Michel, who was a simple guy who just met somebody at the door. Now, that's my story. Over time, we discover lots of things. I discover the power of words. Words are important. We say words, we have no idea what they mean. One of the things I discovered is that grace arises when one receives with gratitude something that has been given gratuitously. And that grace arises for the person who gives with gratitude what he has received gratuitously. Okay? Latin is a beautiful language. Learn it in your spare time. Okay? Medicine has become all about science, hasn't it? All about science. Science has severe limitations. Only now are they starting to realize that McGill University actually now has a group that is studying spirituality in the brain. Okay? It's interesting, isn't it? Well, it used to be like that. The original physical healers used to be spiritual healers as well. There was a word for that. We called them shamans. It used to be one girl guy with one hat. And over the years, well, people decided that cups slip. They decided, because of our intellectual and spiritual limitations, to split things up into the mind, the body, and the soul, and to have different specialists for each one. You know, we go to university, and in university, when we're young, we learn about physics and math and biology and biochemistry. Those are all artificial divisions. That's all BS. That's not how the world works. The world works as a whole. We chop it up so we can understand it because we're limited in our heads. But at some point, it's got to come full circle for us to understand the whole thing. Some of us got to be able to get that. But ever since science has been isolated from the rest, and you know the definition of science, the scientific method, by definition, is we study what is measurable. We measure dosing, we measure outcomes, our studies, that's what science does. Science measures things. Okay? Well, for the longest time, we had the doctors, the scientists, walking hand in hand with the priests. Now we had two people with two different hats, you know? And so over time, something happened, and all of a sudden, people started polarizing to the point where it seemed that science and spirituality were on opposite ends and were facing each other instead of walking together in the same direction. And right now, I think we're at a point where things are coming back together. And I think, honestly, that the study of the brain, the neurobiology of learning, was created by the study of alcoholism and dependencies. And you guys and your sickness, or your blessing, because I don't like to call it a sickness anymore. We'll get to that, okay? I think you're blessed. But it's helping science move forward. And we're discovering lots of things that we didn't even have an inkling of before. But like Hal said, you've known it for a long time. You know, you don't have to know in order to do. Surprising. But, you know, I could throw a baseball over there and hit that green light probably. If I wanted to build a machine that would do that, it would probably cost me $250,000. And yet we could do it right now. Probably half of the guys here could do that. In today's world, we've become a consumeristic society, unfortunately. It used to be that the way things worked is you started off with being, and then aiming at something, and then doing, and then having. Okay? Ever thought of the word behave? Behave is two words. Be and you shall have. That's the origin of behave. Be and you shall have. In today's society, unfortunately, a lot of people have it backwards. And the propaganda and the publicity try to convince people that that is so. If you have a Rolex, you are somebody. If you have the latest iPhone, you are somebody. And we've come to believe, unfortunately, some of us, that if we have it, we have made it, and that we are it. It's backwards. We should start by being it, going towards it, doing it, and then we'll have it. You know what? Once you've been it, having it is a whole lot less important, isn't it? You know, we purchase things that it's funny that the words that they use, they say such and such a thing is in. All of these things are supposedly in. Look at them properly. They're all out. None of them. Can they sell you courage or generosity or love? Can they put it in a bottle? They tried years ago with Valium, but that's another thing. We'll get to that. Okay? Why is this important for people with dependencies? Okay? Why is being important? Well, we got to understand something that science has discovered about dependencies. Most of you, not all of you, probably 70% of you, have a brain that doesn't respond as well to pleasure as regular people's brains. Now, you decide for yourselves at the end of this, is that a disease Or is that a gift? Okay? You guys, you don't have... And, you know, when I question patients, they'll often tell me, yeah, Dr. Sater, you know what? Ever since I've been 6 years old, I've got this feeling like I'm just... You know, there's always that little thing missing. Everybody else, you know, we go to Dairy Queen and my two brothers have, you know, regular sized vanilla ice cream cones and they're happy. And I eat that same thing and it tastes like cardboard and I want a banana split. And unfortunately, parents who are ill-informed or not informed, they insist on giving everybody the same thing. So you've got two happy kids and you've got one kid who's eating cardboard. And he's just dreaming of the day that he can buy a banana split with extra sprinkles and extra cherries and brownies and, you know, add some more. That's how your brains work. Pleasure doesn't... The dopamine system is not as receptive as other people. I'm not going to call them normals. We'll call them regular people. Okay? Feel sorry for them. Okay? Now, it has other consequences as well. When a child like this connects with something that gives them joy and pleasure. If an alcoholic child, who's an alcoholic yet, but he hasn't started drinking yet, he's got an alcoholic brain, his dopamine isn't working very well, and you give that child a dog, he's going to love his dog to death, and he's going to play for him for hours, because that's what it takes for him to feel the pleasure of the dog. And by doing that, he's going to create a very strong relationship with his dog. And his neighbor... His dopamine is filled up really easy, so he gets a full dopamine load playing with his dog for 20 minutes. 10 years down the road, the dogs die. Who gets most hurt? The kid who loved his dog the most. And so they do that thing that I did at the beginning, right? If I get hurt so much, I feel like I'm going to die. I don't want to die. I'm going to prioritize not dying over happiness, and I'm going to sacrifice happiness in order to not die. And I'm going to create this armor. And then, of course, he's going to grow up, and he's going to discover beer. And that beer is going to fix his dopamine temporarily, eh? Because our brain is a wonderful thing. It metabolizes, there's enzymes in our brain that destroy pleasure. Did you know that? It destroys pleasure. So it always has to be redone, right? It doesn't do that with happiness. Okay? And that's key to what I have to say to you today. So, hey, they don't know how to be happy, and they try to do this thing. It's called alchemy. Remember alchemists that tried to turn copper into gold? Well, if you're refusing this great big load of sadness because you can't deal with it, you're refusing the happiness that's on the other side of the coin. That's how it works. Happy goes with sad. They're two sides of the same coin. Your dog dies, you're sad. You're not unhappy. You're sad. You refuse sadness, you end up with this little itty-bitty bit of sadness. You get home with that, you turn it around, you just go, ooh, just a little bit of happiness. Yuck. But I want to be well. So what do? You fill the void around that with pleasure. You guys have all abused all the possible pleasures on the face of the earth. And you come to therapy and you're all profoundly unhappy because that's the recipe to be unhappy. And there is no alchemy between pleasure and happiness. You can't take this much pleasure and hope that it turns into happiness. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. So what's the way out? Or rather, what's the way in? Okay? The verb to have is very interesting. It comes from French, which comes from Latin. And the verb in French is avoir. Avoir means two things, to have and that can be seen. Material things can be seen. Have you ever seen courage? No. You've seen pictures of people doing things that you thought were courageous, and maybe they were. But have you ever seen courage? Have you ever seen generosity? Can I put it in my pocket? Can I buy it at the corner store? No. Some things you can't see. Anybody here read The Little Prince? If you haven't, read it, please. The French voted it the most important French book in the 20th century. Okay? Saint-Exupéry says something really smart in there. He says, what is essential is invisible to the eye. And if you take the French sentence and you chop it down, like we can chop down Latin words, it's very easy. The language system is very bright. What he's actually saying is to be is not to have. Okay? So what truly exists? Truly exists. Well, the values of who we are truly exist, and we can't see them, and we can't purchase them. Okay? For the Romans and the Greeks and the Phoenicians and the Sumerians before that, they had it all figured out. And they were smart enough to hide the philosophy in the words that we speak. And the word value, before you develop the word value, you have val, which should make you think of a valley. Okay? Valley, do you remember any of you study physics? When you're at the top of the hill, you have potential energy. In the bottom of the hill, you have kinetic energy. Well, in a valley, at the bottom of your hill, you have potential being. And at the top of the hill, you have kinetic being. Okay? So, valer, V-A-L-E-R in Latin, means calm. Think serenity. Valor, badge of valor, means what? It's a badge of courage. Valor means courage. For the Greeks and the Romans, the first values that you build on are the values of calm and courage. Now, how is the essence of this different from material values? Well, material values depend on outcome, don't they? Science depends on outcome. It's measuring things. Do values depend on outcome? Well, okay. Let's say you are scared to death of coming up here on the stand and talking to 500 people. Let's say you gather your courage up and you come on stage and nobody likes your speech and they throw tomatoes. Does that remove the fact that you were courageous? No, it doesn't. Okay, well, let's try another one. Let's try generosity. You have your favorite bike. Well, you got a Toyota Yaris. You don't need it anymore. And your niece is walking 3 miles to school. And it's difficult, but you're generous. And you lend your niece your bike for the school semester. And 2 weeks later, she falls and breaks her arm. Lousy outcome. Does it remove the fact that you were generous? No, it doesn't. Values don't depend on outcome. Material things are finite, aren't they? We can measure them. And they're divisible. I'm going to talk about math here. We're going to have fun. They're divisible. If I have one pie, well, we got 7 pieces. Who's first? And then there's none left. Does courage come in limited numbers? If this side of the room is courageous, does this mean there's none left for this side of the room? How does that work? How does that work? Well, every time we add a new person, we add new fears. And the new fears provide place for new courage. Values aren't available in limited quantity. They're not easy to measure either. Because if you're very afraid of coming up on stage and you come up on stage, and you're not afraid of coming up on stage and you come up on stage, the people who are afraid of coming up on stage look at those two people and say, wow, they're both really courageous. And you know what? It's true for you, but it's not true for you because it doesn't scare you. We can't measure it directly. What scares you might be spiders. Might be something completely different. Okay? So we have to be very careful not to make value judgments about people. Okay? Very careful in both ways. Some people do things we perceive as very courageous and they're not scared at all. There are people on the face of this earth that don't know what fear is. And they are very, very unfortunate people. Because if you don't know what fear is, it's hard to know what courage is. If you don't know what courage is, it's hard to love. It's hard to be honest. It's hard to be faithful. It's hard to be loyal. If you don't know what courage is. So being fearless is maybe not the nice thing we thought it was. Now think back to the 1960s where doctors were giving patients Valium in order to get rid of their fear. We've done a huge disservice to a lot of people by trying to take away fear. That's like somebody goes to the weight room to work out, and I take away all the weights. And then at the end of 5 years, he's weak because he's been lifting 2 pounds, a million reps, and he's going like, geez, I'm still weak. What's going on? Well, somebody took away the weights, buddy. Okay? We haven't done a lot of things good all the time. Material degenerates over time. Values don't. If you're loyal and faithful to your friend or your spouse for 20 years, it's more valuable than 20 weeks and 20 minutes. If your Toyota Corolla is 20 years old, you can bet it's less valuable than one that's on the market today, isn't it? Okay? Material things degenerate with time. They degenerate. Their relationship with time is so important that that you can actually become immortal. How does that work? Well, Mother Teresa died 12 and a half years ago. Mother Teresa did the Einstein thing. Okay, we all have the Einstein thing. Einstein said E equals MC squared. That's an energy, mass, and the speed of light squared. Okay, well, isn't that what human beings have? We have our energy. We have our mass, which is our body. And the speed of light goes at a set speed, and it can be used for measuring time and distance. And what else do we have other than our strength, our body, and the time that we're going to spend on the face of this earth? And Mother Teresa took all of those things, and she became the incarnation of generosity. She became generosity. She transferred from the material into the spiritual of generosity. And her body died. Well, we think of life as what's here and what's changing things. Well, there are people today doing real acts of generosity inspired by Mother Teresa, who died 12 and a half years ago, changing the real world for real people in real time today from the inspiration of what she became and what she still is. So you can't die if you invest in these values. Now, that's really important. Another piece of math is that the material world functions with subtraction. If I have 3 apples, I give 2 away. I only have 1 left, but I feel generous. Okay? It doesn't work like that in the spiritual world. If I give peace, the chances are you're going to give peace. And the more peace I give, the more peaceful I feel. And the more generous I am, the more generous I feel. Hey, there's something going on here that's kind of cool. The more you do it, the more it works, and it just happens by itself. And it doesn't depend on outcome, and it can't be measured, and everybody can have access to it. And it can make you immortal in a funny kind of way. So we're going to do a magic trick. Here's our magic trick. What do you see in there? Anything? Don't say air because it's too easy. Okay, we're in outer space. Nothing, eh? Okay, that one's got nothing. We'll put it over here, okay? So there's nothing on there. What about this one? Nothing? All right. We'll put it here. Good stuff. Okay, we're going to make something really important appear in one of those. Depending on which one you choose, that's where it's going to appear. Okay? I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to choose somebody. Barbara! Okay, this is the paradigm, Barbara. Okay, this is the paradigm. We're going to go into a diamond mine, and you can take away as many as you can carry. Would you like a little piece of nothing or a big piece of nothing? A big piece of nothing. So that means it's not nothing anymore. There was a word for this. Another interesting word that people forget what it means. This is a unit with an open door. Door in French is port. Okay, porte. Well, and a port is a port. So what is this called? This is an op-port unity. That's what this is. Now remember what I said about the dopamine in the addict's brain not being very good and needing more to fulfill? This is your brain. This is a regular brain. Now, you guys are demonized because we live in a society that, unfortunately, is based on has become a consumeristic society, where they try to convince you to fill yourselves up temporarily with stuff that, let's use the word mud. Okay? Now, for sure, you guys got a lot more mud than we guys, okay? And if you spill it, it makes a bigger mess. However, if you learn how to put diamonds in here and you clean out the mud, who really has the disease? Who's blessed? You know where the word blessed comes from? It comes also from French. Blessé, it means hurt. People who are hurt are blessed. You guys get hurt because your dog died. Your wife left you. Your mom died. Your dad moved away. You guys get hurt. It's a blessing. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing bad about this. It's just a cup. It's just a vessel. Depends what you put in it. If you decide to put alcohol or switch that for something else, well, okay, you're full of mud. If you decide to put diamonds, you're very lucky. Okay? So that's the magic trick. Okay, so let's go down the list quickly of what are the opportunities. I'm going to mention a whole lot of bad things that you think are bad things. Okay? What's the opportunity for courage? Fear. Fear. If you're fearful, you can be courageous. It's like weights. The opportunity for strength is heaviness, resistance. Okay? What's the opportunity for calm? The storm. Okay? Life is the storm. Calm is the end point. What's the opportunity for love? Difference is the opportunity for love. It's easy to love something that looks like us, feels like us, thinks like us. It's easy to agree, right? It takes a special kind of love to appreciate what you aren't about. Compassion requires pain in the present for somebody, helped by somebody who has had pain in the past. So pain provides the opportunity for compassion. Position provides the opportunity for respect. When the VP has enough humility to talk to George, the guy cleaning the floor, as if they were equal human beings, that is true respect. Respect means respect. Spect means spectacle. Spectacles. It means to look. To have respect means to look at somebody twice. To look past the guy who's cleaning the floor and see the guy who's working three jobs to send his kids to college. That's respect. And respect comes from the position, because that's where it has to come from, unfortunately. When the VP realizes that, you know what, if my dad hadn't been like this, I haven't got to this school, if I wasn't born with this brain, if I hadn't had my hockey helmet on that day, maybe I'd be washing the floors. Okay? Uncertainty is the opportunity for faith. Not knowing. If I had a picture of me with God and Jesus signed on my wall, faith would disappear. Because I would know. Okay? Takes us back to the Garden of Eden, but that's a whole other story. Badness is the opportunity for goodness. Conflict is the opportunity to be peaceable. And our imperfections are the opportunity for us to be humble. Without opportunities, no values. Stop looking at those opportunities like they were problems. They're not. So people with dependencies are best blessed with this greater void. But you still remain the void. Okay? You aren't what you contain or what you've done. You're just a vessel. You can put what in it what you want. You fill it with diamonds. So I hope that you understand that part of what science is doing can work with what spirituality can do too. Okay? And in good treatment centers, this is what people are talking to you about. Okay? The spiritual isn't part of the science, but it's an essential part of what human beings are. If you associate yourself with the values of being, and it doesn't happen overnight. So what do you do if you're here today and you're in the first month of sobriety? of abstinence. Sobriety goes with serenity, that for me anyway. Well, what do you do? Well, first of all, it's like weights. You can't lift 50 pounds once, and all of a sudden you're strong. Right, guys? You have to go to the gym, you have to do it a number of times. Okay, the same thing goes with values. You're not generous because you give one person $2 one time. Sorry. Okay? You have to do it all. It goes like this. I was, I was, I was, I was, I am. It belongs to me. Okay? When you do that, you fill yourself up. But you fill yourself up with something that crystallizes inside. And like a jello mold, when your body dies, it stays there. And your grandkids, they're not going to remember if you had a Rolex. They're going to remember if you love them, if you spend time with them, if you were honest, faithful, loyal, loving, dedicated. That's what they're going to remember. That lives. And they're going to talk to their grandkids about how their grandfather was. But if you're in the first few years of recovery, what do you do? Like, you can't fill this right away. Okay, fair enough. You got to explain this to your spouses. Send them to me if they complain. The first few years, what you're going to have to do is substitute positive activities, not passivities. So guys, you're golf nuts, you're addicts, you're golf nuts. What are you going to do? You're going to play 3 times a week. The regulars are going to play once every 3 weeks. It's good for them, fixes their dopamine. You guys got to do it 3 times a week, and your spouse has to understand that. But you don't just play golf because you're going to become a golf addict. You play golf with the values of being during the process of golf. So while you're playing golf, you play with courage. You shoot over the lake. It doesn't matter if it plops into the lake. It doesn't matter if it plops in 3 times. You're going to go to bed and you're going to feel, hey, I was courageous today. As opposed to, well, I took the 3 safe shots around the lake and beat my buddy by 1 stroke and hey, I won. Well, I think we've got to start being, firstly being, instead of trying to be first. We've got to get it backwards, okay? So you've got to play with honesty, integrity, generosity, love, respect, compassion, humility, and calmly. And as you invest in the being, you know what happens? All of a sudden, at some point, something kicks in, and you say, I am. And when you are, you become invulnerable. And remember at the beginning, that fear of dying? If you can't die, you don't have to be afraid of great sadness anymore. If you don't have to be afraid of great sadness anymore, you don't have to be afraid of happiness anymore. And if you're not afraid of happiness anymore, you become happy. And you know what happens when you become happy? That dopamine hyporeceptivity business and pleasure in your brain, it becomes irrelevant. It doesn't matter as much anymore. Because when you're young, all you know is joy and pleasure. You don't know happiness. But when you're older and you become happy, hey, if you're happy, maybe you don't need the Rolex and the sports car and the great big house and this and that. Maybe it's not necessary anymore. And that's been my experience with addictions and people as they get better over time. And when people build themselves like that, great things happen. And when countries build themselves like that, great things happen. And when cultures build themselves like that, great things happen. And, you know, you were built on this. This is how it started out. It started out being, going towards, doing, and having. And now, unfortunately for a lot of people, it starts with having and doing. And we're always busy all the time, and we're always acquiring things all the time. But a lot of people aren't taking the time to actually think about being. So I'd like to thank Michelle again, and I'd like to thank you for letting me go over my time a little bit. But not too much. Hey, I wasn't bad. Thanks, guys. And I hoped I succeeded in sharing some of the wealth with you guys today. Have a really good weekend.
What an inspiration. I think that it's especially poignant today that John has shared with us that the pain that we've all experienced gives us the opportunity for compassion. And if we demonstrate that compassion throughout our lives, we in fact don't die, we live on. I'd just like to end with my thought, and that is that you are giving of yourselves. You're doing this through your service work in AA, and all of us as professionals working in the field of addictions are benefiting from the service that you do. So thank you so much, and thank you for your attention to these wonderful speakers today. I'd like to end with the responsibility statement, please. I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that, I'm responsible. Thank you.